2 Samuel chapter 13, we're continuing from last week's sermon. We've entitled the message, God Brings Evil on David, part 2 now, or the subtitle is David's Dysfunctional Family. And what we're seeing here, you've often heard the phrase, a moment of pleasure for a lifetime of consequences. And we're looking at the lifetime of consequences that David's going to be living out here. Let's get up to speed on what we looked at last week. I'll just real quick run through the five thoughts, the five divisions of the chapter to this point. We saw Amnon's lust, that he lusted after his sister Tamar, and then Jonadab's plot. Amnon had a friend named Jonadab who helped him figure out how to enjoy his lust. Number three, Amnon's gross sin, that he fell into both incest and a rape of his half-sister, of his sister Tamar. Number four, Tamar's grief, how she ripped her garments and she put ashes on her head and she went on crying. She's lost her virginity. And then number five, Absalom's bitterness. He knew that Amnon had been with her, and he just kind of internalized it. He didn't do anything at the moment, but the bitterness is beginning to grow, and that's where we pick up here with number six, David's silence. And so we have this sequence of events that now leads us to David's response when he hears about all that's happened. We see it 2 Samuel 13, verses 20 and 21. It says, "And Absalom, her brother, said unto her, Hath Amnon thy brother been with thee? But hold now thy peace, my sister. He is thy brother. Regard not this thing." So Tamar remained desolate in her brother Absalom's house. But when King David heard of all these things, he was very wroth. Period. It's interesting. It says David was very angry, and it's like it's waiting for something else to happen. David was very angry and he went out and he did this and he said that. But it just says he was very angry. And that's it. That's the end of David's part in this. He didn't do or say anything to Amnon about what he had done. Now Amnon was his firstborn son, if you remember. David's got, by the time it's all said and done, he has many sons. He has daughters and many children. Amnon is his firstborn son. And often, what is the firstborn son? He's the one that's going to get the birthright. If we're talking about a kingdom, he's the one that would often be the next to be king. Now, it's already been prophesied by the Lord that one named Solomon would be king. So that's out of the way. But David could have reaffirmed to Amnon that this is why God has not chosen you to be the king. He could have cut him off from certain things as the king's son, but he doesn't do anything. Why do you think that David didn't do anything? Perhaps he is afraid of what Amnon would say. Maybe Amnon would say, well, I learned this sexual perversion from you. You know, you were involved in sexual perversion. You committed adultery with Bathsheba, and I'm just doing what you did. Maybe David's afraid of what Amnon would say. Maybe David feels that he has lost his moral authority, his ability to be able to speak to the issues as his father or as the king and say something. Maybe he feels that he's lost his ability to do that. And this seems to be par for the course going forward for how David was as a father in the discipline of his children. We learn later that another one of his sons, his fourth son, Adonijah, that he tried to be king. And we find out then that David didn't discipline him either growing up. We see this very quickly in 1 Kings 1, verses 5 and 6. Then Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, "I will be king." And he prepared him chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. And his father had not displeased him at any time in saying, "Why hast thou done so?" And he also was a very goodly man, and his mother bare him after Absalom. So this seems to be the same thing, that he would hear of things that Adonijah is doing growing up, and he would never discipline him. He would never displease him. Part of the job of a parent is to displease your children. A lot of parents want to please their children only. They want to be their best friend. They want to be buddy-buddy with them. They never want to do something that would turn them away from them. But we are called here to displease our children. David never did that, and so he has a son that is rebelling. We need to know that as not only parents, but all authorities, that any authority that we have, that our responsibility to do things as authority and our perceived moral authority are two different things. You see, some authority could have a perceived moral authority. People could look up to him. They could respect him. They could value the things that he says because he's a good example. But another one, they could say, he's not a good example. He's a bad guy. He's a loser. I don't listen to him. Your perceived moral authority, though, is different from your God-given authority, from your responsibilities. And even if someone has lost moral authority, he has not lost responsibility from God to carry out certain things and to do certain things. Listen to something like an example, Ephesians 6:4. It says, "And ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord." That verse just says, fathers, you're supposed to do this. It doesn't say, bring them up, fathers, in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, unless you've had certain failures in your life, and now, your children wouldn't listen to you, so you can't be expected, and therefore you're not required to do certain things. It doesn't say that. It just says, if you're an authority, this is what you're called to do. And it's a lie from the world. By the way, people definitely can lose their moral authority. They definitely can lose their voice to speak to things from the world's perspective. But it is a lie from the devil that we've lost the ability to lead because of failures. The devil wants us to quit. He wants us to say, well, I guess I'm done with that. I guess I can never have good input to someone's life for the rest of my life. No. Now, we don't want to be like the Pharisees, obviously, who lived by the motto, do as I say and not as I do. Jesus told his disciples, I want you to do what the Pharisees say, because when they quote the law, you do that. But don't do as they do, because they're a horrible example. God doesn't want us to be like that as authorities. He doesn't want us to continue to live a bad example, but say, do as I say. So we're not calling for hypocrisy here. What we're calling for is when there is a failure, that we are honest and open about it, that we are humble, that we repent, and that to those around us that we have failed, that we apologize to them and say, I have failed, but I'm going to do better, and I'm still your authority, and I still want you to listen, I still want you to follow, but I'm not perfect, and I want you to know that. A parent is still a parent, even after a failure. I mean, that's a parent. But we need to strive maybe more than ever to return to fulfilling those responsibilities of a parent instead of giving up and saying, well, I guess I don't have the right to tell anyone how to live now that I've messed up. If you've messed up and repented, you are forgiven by God. You are restored by God to fellowship with him. And now we need to go out and help others to not make the same mistakes that we have. Instead of just saying, well, I don't have moral authority. No, in some ways, we have now a platform to say, don't do what I have done. Look at the heartache. Look at the problems that it causes. But David doesn't appear to do anything like that here. He just doesn't say anything. So there's David's silence. And then number 7, it leads us now to Absalom's revenge. Here's what Absalom then does partly because David does nothing. So we pick it up in verse 22, 2 Samuel 13:22. And Absalom spake unto his brother Amnon, neither good nor bad. For Absalom hated Amnon, because he had forced his sister Tamar. And it came to pass after 2 years, that Absalom had sheep shearers in Baal Hazor, which is beside Ephraim. And Absalom invited all the king's sons. And Absalom came to the king, to David, and said, behold now, thy servant hath sheep shears. Let the king, I beseech thee, and his servants go with thy servant. And he knows David's not going to come. And the king said to Absalom, "Nay, my son, let us not all now go, lest we be chargeable unto thee." And he pressed him, howbeit he would not go, but blessed him. Then said Absalom, "If not, I pray thee, let my brother Amnon go with us." And the king said unto him, "Why should he go with thee?" But Absalom pressed him, that he let Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. Now Absalom had commanded his servants, saying, "Mark ye now, when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, and when I say unto you, smite Amnon, then kill him. Fear not. Have not I commanded you? Be courageous and be valiant." And so Absalom's going to put on a feast, a big shindig, a big to-do. He's going to invite a lot of family, all the kings. There are many of the king's sons here. He's going to invite them all. And then he's got his own servants. And the plan is when people are eating and drinking, when Amnon's good and drunk, when his heart is merry with wine, when he's vulnerable, then I want you to kill him, assassinate him. And then he says to them, "Have not I commanded you? Be courageous and be valiant." Notice that he motivates them. He stirs them up with this courage word. He coerced others into his vengeful plot that he plots for 2 years. Here's his bitterness finally manifesting itself. He coerces others into his vengeful plot by motivating them with the word courage, and they fall for it. We need to make sure that we never confuse courage and sin. Never get those jumbled up. Courage is a very honorable trait. Sin is never honorable. Courage, and we should never ascribe honor to sin. That's a really important principle in life. Never ascribe honor to sin. We live in a world today that does this at every turn, giving out courage awards and calling people heroes because they're not ashamed of their sin. You know, they come out of the closet and they tell the world that they're practicing the sin, the abomination of sodomy, or that they've chosen to reject the way that God has created them and turn nature and right thinking on their heads to embrace another gender. And now that's now labeled as courageous and heroic. That's not courage. It's a sinful rejection of God and his plate and his choices and God's will. Standing up against people that stand up against sin is not honorable, and it should never be honored with the name of courage. Continuing to stand against sin, even though the world labels you as a bigot or a homophobe or hateful, that's true courage. To stand for truth and right, even though the world flips things upside down, that is true courage, and it's not hateful. By the way, it's the most loving thing to do, to point out that sin is sin. That's the most loving thing to do if it's done in the right way. Now, obviously, people can do it in a hateful way. People can go out and murder people that they disagree with, and the Bible never calls for that. But it is love to tell someone they are sinning against God, and here's how you avoid that. Here's how you get that right. But never confuse courage and sin. Absalom tells his men, "Be courageous and assassinate Amnon." That wasn't courage. That was just wrong. Listen to Philippians 3:19. Well, I won't read the whole verse, but I'll paraphrase it. Philippians 3:19, it tells us to beware of those whose God is their belly and whose glory is in their shame. That is so much of our world. Something that is sinful, that they should be ashamed about, but now enough people are on their side. They feel emboldened. They feel empowered to declare their position. And now their glory is in their shame. It's something that is shameful, but they brag and boast about it. The Bible says, beware of those people. They brag about what they should be ashamed of. They make themselves feel better about it by calling it courage. By the way, I wouldn't stand too close to someone receiving one of these courage awards in the name of sin, lest God strike them with lightning and you be consumed with that. Well, let's go on in Absalom's revenge in this story. Look at verse 29. And the servants of Absalom did unto Amnon as Absalom had commanded. They killed him. Then all the king's sons arose, and every man gat him up upon his mule and fled, lest they be next. They didn't know if it was just for them or if they were going to kill all the sons. Verse 30, and it came to pass while they were in the way that tidings came to David, saying, Absalom hath slain all the king's sons, and there is not one of them left. Then the king arose and tore his garments and lay on the earth, and all his servants stood by with their clothes rent. And Jonadab, here he is again, this friend of Amnon, quote unquote. And Jonadab, the son of Shimea, David's brother, answered and said, let not my lord suppose that they have slain all the young men of the king's sons. For Amnon only is dead. For by the appointment of Absalom, this hath been determined from the day that he forced his sister Tamar. Now therefore, let not my lord the king take this thing to heart, to think that all the king's sons are dead. For Amnon only is dead. You know something about Jonadab here? Is that when they escaped, when someone escaped and told that all the king's sons, there wasn't someone else beside him that said, by the way, it's not all of them, it's just Amnon. He already knew that it was only Amnon. He knew before this day ever happened that Amnon was going to die. And yet notice, he never does anything to stop it. He never told David, by the way, they're all going to that party. You shouldn't let Amnon go because Absalom's going to kill him. He knew that this is what's going to happen. But he doesn't tell David about it. He doesn't tell Amnon about it. He knows about it, but he does nothing. He just allows it to go. We mentioned last week that Jonadab is kind of a picture here. He kind of plays the role of the devil in this story. And he does it twofold. First of all, he comes to Amnon and says, oh, Amnon, you like this? Here's a way to do it. He gives a plot. He gives an idea. He devises mischief. He tempts Amnon to do wrong. And then after Amnon does wrong, he cuts him off as a friend. Now he probably continues to hobnob with him. But he knows for 2 years that Absalom's going to kill him, and he does nothing to stop it. He gets him into the trouble, and then he allows the trouble to take him away to his death. Here's how the devil hates us. Here's how the devil is our enemy. He's our enemy by being our friend and then by being our enemy. Let me put it this way. The devil is our enemy. He fights against us by pretending to be our friend and saying, hey, do this. And then when we do it, he goes to God and he says, look what he did. He accuses us to God when it was his idea in the first place. And the devil gets you coming and going. We need to learn how to see through that. Any temptation to do wrong, even though it seems friendly, is an enemy. That is against you. And Jonadab does this. He gets Amnon into the trouble, and then he stands by and watches him get assassinated. He knows the whole time, but he then stands by and watches the deed get done. Let's go on and look at verse 34. It says, but Absalom fled. And the young man that kept the watch lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, there came much people by the way of the hillside behind him. And Jonadab said unto the king, behold, the king's sons come. As thy servant said, so it is. And it came to pass, as soon as he had made an end of speaking, that behold, the king's sons came and lifted up their voice and wept. And the king also and all his servants wept very sore, because their oldest brother Amnon is dead now. But Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Amihud, king of Geshur. And David mourned for his son every day. So, and by the way, he's mourning for Absalom every day, not Amnon. Amnon's dead. He's not mourning for him anymore. But he mourns for Absalom because he's gone. Let's see, now we're on verse 38. So Absalom fled and went to Geshur and was there 3 years. And the soul of King David longed to go forth unto Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Amnon, seeing he was dead. So when Absalom fled, it says he went to Geshur, which is just east, by the way, of the Sea of Galilee on the other side of the Jordan River. Jerusalem's in the south, and you go up the Jordan River. The top of the Jordan River is the Sea of Galilee. Bottom of the Jordan River is the Dead Sea. And he goes to Geshur, which is just on the east side of the Sea of Galilee, to live with the king of Geshur. Who is this king of? Why does he go to Geshur? What's the connection? This is his grandfather on his mother's side. David has married, this is our profound thought for today, David married Absalom's mother. But the father of Absalom's mother is the king of Geshur. By the way, we see this 2 Samuel chapter 3 and verse 3. This is telling that David's sons are born in Hebron. And here are the sons that are born in Hebron, 2 Samuel 3, 3. And the third, Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. So Maacah is one of David's wives, and she is the daughter of the king of Geshur. So Absalom runs away, and he runs to his mom's father. He runs to his maternal grandfather, and he lives there. He's got a place of refuge. By the way, he couldn't go to any of the cities of refuge in Israel. There were cities of refuge that you could go to escape the death penalty if your killing was an accidental killing. But what he has done is murder, cold-blooded murder. He couldn't have gone to any of the cities of refuge and survived. They would have delivered him up to be slain. By the way, I don't think David would have gone after him to slay him. He wants to bring him home, even though he should have been put to death. But he goes to Geshur because presumably they won't deliver him up. So Absalom, he stands on his own, obviously, for what he does. His revenge, his murder of his brother, his bitterness. But the whole situation could have been helped and maybe even totally averted if David had done what he should have as his father and as the king. If David had taken matters into his authority, his hands as the authority, and done what he should have, then presumably Absalom could have been satisfied with that if David had handled Amnon properly. Absalom, notice, he takes up another person's offense. What Amnon did was not to Absalom, it was to his sister. But Absalom took the offense personally and took revenge as if he had been wrong. We always need to be careful of that, about taking up another person's offense. What Absalom should have done was, and this word is really simple, very difficult, and unthinkable for so many in the world, but this is biblical. What Absalom should have done was forgive. He should have gone and told, Absalom was the first one who knew of this, outside of Jonadab and Amnon. But Absalom was the first one who knew of Amnon's sin. And when he heard about it, he should have said to his sister, you know, go to my house the way he did. But then he should have gone and told his father, David. He should have told the king of the nation what had been done. And then leave the results of that in his authority's hands. And then forgive. And he doesn't have to carry that with him. That 2-year bitterness, which leads to murder, which leads to the 3-year exile, and so forth and so on. All that could have been averted if he had just handled it with the proper channels and then forgiven. The word forgive means to send away. It's a very beautiful word in the Bible. It's a very freeing word. Because if we don't forgive, if we hold on to an offense, that bitterness eats us alive, as we looked at last week. What Absalom should have done was to send away that wrong, and he doesn't have to be burdened by it anymore. Listen to Colossians 3 and verse 13. It says, forbearing one another and forgiving one another. If any man have a quarrel against any, even as Christ forgave you, so also do ye. You see, the world looks at it and says, oh, I could never forgive. What do you mean just forgive? That doesn't make any sense. Here's why, as Christians, we can forgive. We are empowered to forgive, if I can use that phrase, where the world doesn't have this power. Because we realize that we've done hell-deserving sins to God, and He has forgiven us. And the same way that Jesus has forgiven us, we can apply that to them. You say, well, what do you mean, how can I forgive? We just take the example of Jesus. And that's why we can never get too far from our salvation. Rehearse that day by day. Let it blow your mind again that I deserved hell and Jesus just forgave me. He just sent my sin away because he paid for it on the cross. And we need to take that and apply that forgiveness to other people. We can forgive. I love that verse because it says, if any man has a quarrel against any, it's 100% things. It doesn't matter who has done it to you. It doesn't matter what they've done. It doesn't matter who has been done to. We can forgive because we have been forgiven. That's what Absalom should have done. Instead, it ruined his life. So what we see here in this chapter is you've seen those old, maybe those old insurance commercials where life comes at you fast. All of a sudden you're driving down the road and wham, you know, your car gets smashed by a tree. Now what do? I wasn't expecting this. And so you always need to be ready for whatever may come with insurance or whatever. And life does come at you fast. All of a sudden here, now things have been bubbling under the surface and waiting, but all of a sudden, one day, because of David's sin, he can look and see that his children are devastated. One is raped. One is murdered for committing the rape. One is exiled for committing the murder. And they're all traumatized. His family has fallen apart. And David seems to lack the authority to speak to any of it and to handle it properly. All of a sudden, David's whole family is turned upside down. And what we see here in this chapter is a combination of two things. You see it all through the Bible. You see it all throughout the world around us. We see a combination of the sovereignty of God and the free will of man. It's important to note that combination. There's much to point to by way of people involved to fault them. And they are responsible. All the people are responsible for their own choices. Amnon's responsible for his choice. Absalom's responsible for his choice. Jonadab, David, they're all responsible. At the same time, we need to see that what's happening in this chapter is the work and judgment of God on David for his sin with Bathsheba and his sin with murdering Uriah. And God is bringing all of these events and all of these happenings, God is causing it to happen. Listen to Isaiah 45 and verse 7. We've mentioned this verse recently, but I want to see how it applies here. God says, I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. And that word evil, God says, I create evil. That's negative consequences. It's judgment. And apply that to 2 Samuel 12:11, which is what this chapter is based on. David had sinned with Bathsheba. God says through Nathan the prophet, thus saith the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against thee out of thine own house. And that's what's being borne out in this chapter. All this is coming from his own house, from his own family. His children are devastated. Sons, a daughter is raped. And God, it's not just negative circumstances happening. It says, God says, I will raise up evil against thee. You say, well, this wasn't God that did it. Amnon's the one who did the sin. And Jonadab had this bad advice and Absalom committed murder. It wasn't God, it was these people. God says, I will raise it up. And so it's not that God was for all the sins that these people did. What they did was wrong, and they all stand accountable for their own choices. But God orchestrated it all and allowed it to happen and didn't stop it. God can stop anything at any time if he wants to, but he didn't stop it. He started it and allowed it to happen. So when you see God in it, here's how it plays out. God allowed Amnon to see his sister, and it was Amnon's lust that caused him to have these desires. And then God allowed Jonadab to be in his life, to have the idea for how he could get away with rape. And then God allowed Amnon to do the sin. He allowed Absalom to hear of it. And he allowed that bitterness to start to boil. He allowed David to do nothing. And then he allowed Absalom to commit murder and run away. And this, and the story is going to go on that David never handles it properly with Absalom. And he allows, there's bitterness that continues to boil inside Absalom until eventually Absalom gets the idea, I'm going to take over the kingdom. I'm going to be king. And then You know, eventually Absalom takes 10 of David's concubines and sins with them, and it all comes full circle. But it all started this series, and so you see they're all connected. This is a one long series of events that starts when David sinned with Bathsheba. He had no idea that he had knocked over a domino that was going to knock over another domino, and this was going to continue for years, for decades. This is going to define the rest of David's life. And it's all, we see God's hand in the whole thing. It's not just random circumstances. God says, I will raise up evil against David. One thing that we notice in this chapter is that it's kind of life without God. I don't know if you noticed as we read the chapter, but God's name is never mentioned once in 2 Samuel chapter 13. The entire cast of characters fails. Amnon, he's got lust, he fails. Jonadab, his friend, he plays the role of the tempter, he fails. Absalom is bitter and then murders, he fails. David does nothing, he fails. The entire cast of characters in this story are big failures. There's no redeeming qualities at any turn. There are no bright spots. At no point did someone bring God into a conversation. When it starts, when Amnon goes to Jonadab, and Jonadab says, hey, what's wrong? Why are you so sad? He says, oh, I love my sister Tamar. Jonadab doesn't say anything like, oh, well, you know, you need to stop it right there. I mean, God says this in the Bible. You shouldn't do that. He never says that. And when he gives him the idea about how to rape her, Amnon doesn't say, hey, you know, that idea, that's deceitful, it's lying, that's against God. They never bring up God. When Absalom hears of what's happened, he just allows the bitterness to boil inside. He doesn't say, well, God says, you know, that I should love and forgive. When David, nobody ever applies God to a conversation or to an action. God is just gone in the whole chapter. And this is what happens when, even as believers, we live life without God. Anything is possible. Rape, incest, murder, exile. Anything is possible if you live life without God. I want to finish with this verse. Listen to Psalm 10 and verse 4. It says, the wicked, through the pride of his countenance, will not seek after God. God is not in all his thoughts. A wicked man, one of the characteristics of a wicked person is that he goes through life and God is not in any of his thoughts. He never thinks, what does God think about that? He never does this because this is what God wants. God is just absent. It's practical atheism, and believers can get there too. Where we can wake up and just roll out of bed. We don't think about God. We can eat our meals. We don't stop to thank God for the meals. We can go to work. We never ask God direction, we never ask for protection, we never ask for wisdom. We just do life. And all of a sudden, the day is over and we get up and do it again. And whenever we don't purposely interject God into life, this is what we can find. And so this family here is devastated. This is the family of a man after God's own heart who took a day off of following God and then took 9 months off from following God. And he so deeply, and now he is reaping. This is the sweet psalmist of Israel. He wrote scripture, but he walked away from God briefly, and now his family is devastated. And whenever we live seasons of life without God, we can't expect anything better. Now we throw ourselves on God's mercy, but we can't expect or demand anything better than this. We need every day to purposefully bring God before our eyes. In all thy ways, acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths. We need that direction. We need his blessing. Don't live life without God. Let's pray together.